And that means it's time for the first hour of the Dr. and Mrs. Future program.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. Ladies and gentlemen, KSCO presents the Dr. Future Show. If you would like to join in our show today, you can call us at 831-479-1080. That's 831-479-1080. And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Good afternoon, everyone. Hello, hello, hello. Mrs. Future.
Good day.
Good day. Bobby.
Good day.
Good day. Yeah. Good day.
Wow.
Yeah. Well, you know, I finally get to know a little bit more about what your weather is like there in San Francisco, because it's like that in Aptos. Very cloudy.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's kind of a little chilly, but nice. 72 degrees through the, you know, so it's probably not as thick as it is where you are.
I think Aptos has always been a
problem. Yeah, we got 66.
66. Yeah, a little colder in San Francisco.
All right. Yeah.
But
there was some, you know, sometimes the sun breaks through and, you know, I run outside and get as much sun as I can.
There's a spot. Yeah.
Vitamin D, hurry.
Exactly.
Go soak it up.
Exactly.
That's great. Good. Well, with any luck, we'll see you later today.
Yeah. I'm
Bobby's going to make it down
right
the coast.
The show.
Yeah, fantastic.
All right. That'll be a beautiful drive for you, I'm sure. Yeah.
Well, in the second hour, we're going to have Don Davis on, the space artist.
Yes.
Quite well renowned. And we're going to get his impressions of the James Webb Telescope and what that opens up for new vistas, not just for astronomers, which he is as well, but also as a space artist. What new things might be inspired by seeing these giant nurseries in space where
stars
are being born.
And how many grains of sand of the sky can we illustrate in one person's lifetime?
Yeah. What can we illustrate here? So that's the second hour.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, open lines today, and you got some wonderful stories that we're going to be sharing with
you. That's right. We are not afraid to look up.
That's right. And speaking of looking up, I thought it was very interesting this week about why Jupiter doesn't have those glorious rings like Saturn.
Yeah. What's going on with that? What should we know about rings? Well, I've seen pictures where it does have rings, but apparently they're so filmy and flimsy that they're almost invisible most of the time.
Yes, Jupiter does have rings, but they're that little tenuous, thin, flimsy things of dust, only visible when backlit by the sun kind of ring, not very impressive.
Backlit by the sun, so we can really only see the rings of Jupiter from a satellite.
Certain angles.
Wait a minute, backlit. Yeah, I think for it to be backlit, Jupiter would have to be between us and the sun. That doesn't happen. That happens with our cameras.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a number of simulations that was done on the objects orbiting the Jovian system. And these simulations took into account the orbital motion of Jupiter and the motions of its moons, its four largest moons especially. They're known as the Galilean moons.
Mm-hmm, because Galileo saw them.
Yeah, right.
With his telescope.
The advantage of being a pioneer. Things
right.
Named after you.
Uh-huh.
Ganymede, which is larger than Mercury, is the largest moon in the solar system. Callisto, Io, and Europa.
Mm-hmm.
And they added how long it might take for a ring system to form. And under this modeling, Jupiter didn't have any of those giant Saturn-style rings. And it's unlikely that it ever did, according to the simulations. They say that massive planets form massive moons, which prevents them from having substantial rings.
Hmm.
Because of the large size of the moons and the gravitational forces that these giant moons are exerting on the system, it would quickly destroy any large rings that might want to form.
Hmm. I see. So it's sort of like having a big vacuum around the dust particles that would otherwise be rings. You've got these
gravity fields,
these satellite dust busters.
like giant magnets almost, the way they influence things.
Right. Yeah, they'll suck them into the planet instead of letting them float like clouds in rings.
And those are dust. Now, Saturn's different. Saturn's rings are mostly made of ice.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the different materials. So, and they think, well, how did that happen? How would Saturn get all this ice crystals? And they're thinking, well, comets, asteroids maybe, or icy moon that broke apart, some are colliding with something else, they don't really know. But that's part of why we're investigating those things, to see if we can figure it out.
So maybe Saturn is the first big planet that it's before Jupiter in terms of...
It's after Jupiter in terms of orbits.
I'm talking about from the outside in. If you're talking about debris coming from the Kuiper belt that might contain water, it's going to run into Saturn first. And that might give Saturn the advantage in collecting the water.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that, Mrs. Future. What do you think, Bobby?
I heard Jupiter's pretty influential in that, too. But Saturn, it's out there further, so it would catch them first, right?
Yeah, that's it.
As far as large objects.
Sure.
And trap them.
No ice left for Jupiter. Jupiter has to be a thirsty planet because Saturn's sucking up all the ice crystals.
Jupiter, dust for you. Dust.
Father time is getting the cloud particles.
Well, curiously enough, you know, Saturn's moons play a significant role in shaping and maintaining those beautiful rings.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that that's because the moons are smaller. If Saturn did have a giant Jupiter-sized moon, it would disrupt the rings. And it would cause strange ice orbiting the planet in some kind of who knows what kind of orbit.
Wow.
Yeah.
A universe without the rings of Saturn. That would be a sadder universe.
We also know that the ice giants, Neptune and Uranus, ones further out there, according to your theory, Mrs. Future, they'd collect it first.
If they were big, Saturn's pretty big compared to the other planets.
Well, Neptune and Uranus have thin, tenuous dust rings.
Oh, uh-huh.
And no ice rings, as far as we know.
Huh.
And strangely enough, Uranus is tipped on its side relative to the other planets.
I see.
So something smacked Uranus and knocked it sideways. Or once it had absolutely enormous rings that might have caused it to have a sideways tilt. We don't really know.
Let's see. I heard someone once describe the entire solar system as a spaceship. And the two gyros that our solar system is steered with are the ballast of Jupiter in the middle and the gyro of Uranus out there, you know, with the pole facing the opposite direction of all the other planets.
Interesting. Do you think the solar system has rings?
The solar system?
In itself, yeah, some kind of giant rings.
Well, I'm sure there's some kind of gravitational rings. There's definitely an energy imprint in the sea of energy that is the universe.
We'll have to ask Dawn when he comes on.
Yeah, let's see what Dawn says about solar rings beyond the Kuiper belt.
Yeah, solar system rings.
Beyond the heliosphere.
Yes. Are there rings in the heliosphere, Dawn? Okay, let's go to a break and get back to some more stories.
All right, be right back.
Okay.
Dr. and Mrs. Future and Bobby Wilder. Hang tight.
Okay, welcome back. Let's go from outer space to the ground world for a moment, something we can all connect with, and that's the idea of homes.
Oh, yeah, we don't need rockets to get to homes.
Yeah, homes are nice to have now in space-time.
I think most people feel that way.
In case you haven't heard, America is in the midst of a serious housing crisis. In 2020, Freddie Mac, the mortgage lender, put the shortage at 3.8 million homes in our country. And why? Why is there such a shortage? Labor problems, supply chain snarls, raw material costs from the pandemic shutdowns, stuff like that. So basically, homes are outpacing the supply.
So if we have like 360 million people and we are short 3.8 million homes, that's sort of like 1% of the people need homes that aren't available.
1% of
families, 1% of... Well, I'm just doing population, straight population per house.
Yeah. So what to do about it?
Good question.
Well, one of the methods we like to mention before we take our caller is the use of 3D printing,
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And I want to talk about
it. That's an emerging new industry.
It is. There's a project going on in the East Coast called Project Virginia.
Okay. I guess okay. It's in Virginia then?
Yeah, that's right. It's a small... It's kind of interesting because Virginia has been the leader in experimental housing in the past.
Really? When?
They had a town they built in the late 60s, early 70s called Reston, Virginia, which was supposed to be a model city. You know, a city building a city from scratch.
Good place to rest?
Yeah, it's an interesting experiment. Also nearby in Columbia, Maryland, in the state of Maryland, was another experimental city. And I got to live there for a year, get to see what happens. And it was built a little bit after Reston, but it was a sister city in many respects.
What was it called?
Columbia, Maryland.
Columbia, Maryland, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
I see.
Pretty interesting.
So you like these...
I did.
Experimental living conditions.
Well, they were a little like living in plastic land. You know, they weren't quite the character of a real city, but they're working on it, right? Uh-huh. And we've learned a lot in the last 60 years. So.
Was there anything that you liked about it that was kind of unusual?
I liked the fact that you could go to the convenience store without having to cross any streets. The whole thing was designed that way. I liked having village centers, several village centers, and a downtown area as well. I like the way it was all, the little satellites. It was kind of like a little solar system in many ways. And that kind of worked for me.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think Reston had canals, so you could actually canoe or kayak where you wanted to go to work and stuff like that.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, yeah. So they thought of that. They thought about reducing the amount of space for traffic on the typical grid system. The roads can take up to 40% of the land, while if you curve the roads, like you see in a lot of burbs, you will reduce the land usage considerably.
Oh, so you can have more land for yards and houses and...
I think the projections were 9%. You could under 9% from 40% of the land going into the road infrastructure.
Wow. And then you could take that...
Curved roads, yeah.
Curved roads. And if you just would pave them with solar panels...
I want the idea that the populace could walk a lot and walk around and save solar panels. Anyway, it's called Project Virginia. And as I said, just before we take your color, they're working with the 3D printing technology today. They're working at building 200 houses over the next few years in Virginia using 3D printing technology.
Wow. And yeah, they're going to print the exterior walls. And
yes.
And then they'll build the rest of the house from there.
Yeah. And they can go pretty fast.
It's 22 hours to complete of the 200 houses.
Yeah, for the outside infrastructure. So the idea that we are having the technology to rapidly create houses if we have the will to do so.
All right.
All right, well, so let's take our call.
Sounds like we have people who'd like to live in them. So let's start.
Yeah.
Let's say hi to Alan in Salinas.
Hey, Alan Salinas, how you doing?
Alan,
doing good. Just wondering what your guys' thoughts are on space debris. I noticed I was reading the news, and they said that China, for the third year in a row, has sent a rocket up where the booster is going to be coming to Earth, and one that just staged from the park that it let go from is 20 tons, and they don't seem too concerned about it. But if you put the numbers together, within probably 10 years, there's going to be a fatality. They've got it 3 years in a row, and they're not alone. The United States is guilty of doing the same thing, especially the military, sending things up and let it fall to the ground. So what's your guys' thoughts? I got to get running, but I'm listening on the radio.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. You touched on a very important topic, and we've done many stories on that. And, yes, it is an issue. There's a lot of things that could go wrong in space. I was just reading that we could have a huge solar flare that would take hundreds of satellites out of their current orbits, and they have to find them. They'd lose them, and they have to re-find them on the radar, so that could cause problems. There's ones that just go wrong, and so there's lots of machines that could fall into each other and create cataclysmic chain events. It's really an issue. There are people that are looking at that. Steve Wozniak, one of the founders of Apple Computer, has a startup company that is space sweepers, basically. They're going to go up and find the dead debris and clean it up and maybe deorbit it, send it back to Earth and collect the valuable minerals that might be on board.
About 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had an article where a lot of the people in the space industry were discussing coming up with a plan for deorbiting any kind of satellite. So
and
beginning some process of licensing what goes up with the technology to make sure it comes down safely.
They do have some infrastructure already in place regarding that. There's an area in the South Pacific, I believe, where they try to deorbit satellites as sort of burial ground for dead space debris.
Yeah.
And that's usually away from civilizations.
Yeah. And before we all go worrying about things falling from the sky and hurting us and hitting us on the head, there is a lot of understanding of what is orbiting the Earth and what its planned trajectories are for the ones that we're tracking. And there's the ability to anticipate ones that might be trouble. And we're also a water planet with 70% of the surface covered by water. It'll be hard to specifically hit something on the ocean if you were trying, and some of that, of course, could lend itself to accidents, but...
Mm. The good news is that the atmosphere burns up most of it.
Yeah, there you go. So, we do have to think about it as we...
It's big. You know, if you
build more and more stuff in space.
Absolutely. But it is a big area. Keep that in mind also. I mean, as vast as we think of the oceans, they're small compared to the orbital areas around the planet. I mean, just look at the Earth from the side... And then imagine 2/3 of that is water on the surface. Then imagine going out a couple hundred miles, an area that goes out from maybe 100 miles to 300 miles.
Yeah, the bowl that contains the planet.
Beyond that, you can just see how it's a big sphere of space that is vast, hugely vast, vaster than the oceans. And we have the technology to GPS it all, to create it so that we can track things. And we should. And as we develop our infrastructure...
Or beyond tracking, yeah, we also have to make sure that everything that goes up in space,
yeah,
has an intelligence system that guides it safely out of harm's way so that nothing bad happens.
But there are unknown factors like solar flares that can cause hundreds of things to go off course all of a sudden.
That's right. And technology
of course,
is
a big
not
solar
foolproof.
Flare would take boats off course. It would take... Tesla's on auto self-drive, possibly off course.
Yeah, all you Atlanteans, yeah, out there who are depending, yeah, on technology for your future, you've got to beware. You know, nature's still bigger.
Beware, solar flare. I haven't seen any signs like that, have you?
No, but it's,
yeah,
definitely
beware, solar flare.
Good idea. Yeah. Ready for the next caller here?
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, let's say hi to Steve in Santa Cruz. Hey, Steve, how are
Steve?
You?
Steve. Hey, Futures. Okay, listen, I've got the solution. Before I get to it, you got to give me a minute to get to the end here because
right,
I've got the solution.
But you only have 2 minutes before the break, so keep it in mind. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, housing. You know what? People are people, whether they come in to the country legally, whether they come in the country illegally, whether they're homeless, however they get here, they need a roof over their head.
Yeah, they're all humans.
We're all humans, so... Mm-hmm. I'm going to leave the politics out of this right now, mm-hmm, and just say, if you're going to let an extra million people a year in, you better be ready to house them. Mm. So looking at that, mm-hmm, and I'm not going to factor in how many people die off and how many babies are born and all that stuff, but look, we've clearly got a shortage. So here's the solution. Mm-hmm. I go up to Vancouver every once in a while.
Yeah.
When I stay up there, I notice there's very few, if any, homeless. And one of the reasons is, they have public housing for people up there. Now, I'm a conservative politically, but I've changed my views on housing and how that should be handled because it is not working. Our situation is not keeping up with evolution. So up there, they have socialized housing. Everyone has a shelter.
Yeah.
And I think we're going to have to start thinking like that. People need a place to be. They can't live on the sidewalk.
I like what you're thinking about there, Steve. I'm definitely into humans solving belly button related problems. You know, like how do we make sure that every person has a safe place to be and sleep at night and access to the environment that feeds them and keeps everyone mentally sane? We really need to think it through.
Bobby would know about this probably too because when you go to Vancouver, when you visit Vancouver, it's a beautiful city. It's clean. It's well laid out. Big high-rise buildings. They're not eyesores, and people,
yeah,
live in them.
All right,
that's
Steve,
true.
Let's talk about this after
you want to hold
break,
on for
huh?
the through the break?
Hang tight.
Sure.
Yeah, hold on.
Yeah, great.
Be
right back. Great
talk
stuff.
To Steve about housing. Be right back.
Just be quiet.
Okay, welcome back to the show. Yes, we were just talking about the 3D printing of housing and how that might be a potential solution for the housing crisis, considering that you can print a new house infrastructure in 22 hours with the proper 3D printer technologies.
It's a technical solution. If there's a will, there's a way. Yeah, but there a will?
One hand affects the other. Uh-huh. We have Steve on the line. We were just discussing the whole issue of housing. Steve, did you have a particular point you want to bring up with our audience?
Yeah. Dr. Future, you know when you stand at Aquatic Park down on Fisherman's, down by, Aquatic Park down by Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco?
Oh, sure.
Bobby, you know this area really well. Mm-hmm. And you look up, and there's these two apartment towers that have these convex surfaces that look out onto the bay. Have you ever seen those two towers, Bobby?
Yeah, those, I've been up in one of those towers.
Didn't MZ have an apartment
amazing
there?
View.
MZ and Amy?
Yeah.
They're beautiful. Yeah. I've always liked those towers because the design of the way they're curved. So you can design high-rise that are appealing, artistic, aesthetic, and welcome the environment. So when I think of the city of Vancouver, how they've dealt with that, with their housing problem up there, the high rises are not offensive. They blend in with the cityscape. And I think we need to start thinking about housing humans, not letting them end up on the bench limbs and living on pallets, you know?
Sure. Well, I would love to participate in that conversation with people who are on the front line. I'm very interested in the well-being of humans, and I really believe that we have what it takes to get past our differences and make it work. That there's sort of a different solution for everyone.
And you brought this up before. There's no shortage of cash. I mean, look, didn't Bezos just make $30 million on a house and he sold in San Francisco?
Yeah. Cash is an invention. Cash is a belief in our mind. It's an abstraction from real value. And people who study why it is not serving our needs can tell you that it basically follows the powerful and their direction. And the, you know, you can attribute it to greed, but it's really the profit motive and the way that people take it out of the system, but they don't put it back.
Well, that's why you need the fourth line in capitalism.
Well, yeah. And when I think about buildings like that, it's just basically redirecting resources. Yeah. Direct resources towards something productive instead of something destructive.
Well, and really, we have to get past where it's all ideas without bodies, because the reason we're having a shortage of anything right now is because the people of our world are choosing to do something other than solve those particular problems. And so we have to back up and say, well, how do we prioritize these problems and have people who can solve them? Because we're a country full of free individuals who are directing themselves. So it's kind of hard to give them a plan where everybody pulls together.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking one of the original visions back in the 80s we had of the evolving technologies that would create for us a leisure culture, that the machines would do all the work and we'd be able to be more free as human beings and not be into this 19th
century.
You
could get beyond slavery.
Slavery work
having ethic. The elites think that they've got to support the slaves and the slaves are not supposed to think for themselves.
Which worked fine for the time, but this is the 22nd century. We have robots. We have AI.
I don't think it ever worked fine. It never worked fine. Slavery is not a cool thing.
It wasn't a full win. I agree with that. We got to do better. But we still need a lot of work done. And if not humans, then...
Well, I think people are willing to work when it's in their best interest.
Yes, they're willing and if it's to fun and enjoyable. And
they're not going to have it stolen from them. They're willing to put their energy, if they're not building their mansion in someone else's backyard, just in time to get kicked out of it right when it's done. Right?
Yeah, we can't live like that anymore. And you heard about the investment brokerages that are buying up all the trailer parks in the country. just because of good real estate investment.
Yeah, I was just reading that on the desk here at KSCO.
Yeah, you know, our legal system is going to have to go through some serious renovations to recover from the fact that we've given all our power to these fictions called corporations, and that they're acting like just because they've aggregated the power through money, they have more rights than people. That's one of the big problems with our legal system right now.
Yeah, let's hope so. That's no way for us to live. And those people that have lived their lives that way in a safety and comfort, and then to have these T-Rex groups come in and just take over just because they have more cash.
Well, you know, some of these T-Rex groups probably have good intentions, too. I mean, that's the whole thing. It's like, it's real easy to demonize the top because they're so removed from the people that you know. But people get to the top by having an idea that unifies the energy and gives it some momentum. And, you know, there are good people in all walks of life trying to solve big problems. So we just have to come up with ways to have transparency, have some kind of way of knowing who's actually doing good for the world and who's not, right? We've got to get beyond our misinformation era.
Dr. Future,
yes.
Some of those trailer parks, they do let the people own a piece of the pie, right? That's probably a safer bet.
Yeah, yeah. When ownership definitely conveys some more responsibility into how you treat things, at least in our culture.
And in answer to that question, I'm not really up on a specific example, but I did have a relative who was involved in creating housing, public-private housing partnerships. And they created developments that would have, say, like 80 units being developed, and they would be financed by being like a third are going to be sold privately as condominiums to raise money and have owners. A third are going to be rented out and owned by, say, the developer. Maybe it's the city or maybe it's a housing organization. And a third is going to be set aside as low-income housing that has a subsidy from, say, like the federal government so that people who are needing support have access to it. And so then they build a project like that, and that's where all the money comes from. So it does exist.
It seems to be working. It's a formula that does work. And we'll pursue this more. Thanks, Futures.
You bet. Yeah. Thanks, Steve.
Big topic. Always evolving. And where do we go from
here? Thanks for taking it up. Bye-bye.
You bet.
Got one more caller.
Okay, let's take the next caller.
Peter and Gilroy. Hi, Peter. Hi. Welcome to the show.
Peter, hey.
Hello, folks. I really enjoy your program.
Oh, thank you.
It's always so informational, and we're talking about the housing issue here in California and the West in general.
Yeah, sure.
Yes. Although nobody really talks about the elephant in the room, which is water, and I just want to preface my comment that I serve as the chair of our local resource conservation district in this area in the Pajaro Watershed.
Yeah. Cool.
And I'm also the vice chair of the Ag Water Advisory Committee for the Santa Clara Valley Water District.
Wow.
The issue is that we don't have enough water for the amount of housing that we need. And actually, with this prolonged drought, we don't have enough water for the housing that we already have.
Yeah, given the existing infrastructure. I agree. But that's why we've been doing stories on new ways of generating water. For example, the new techniques for using material science for taking it out of the air itself seems to be much more efficient than ever before. And we should be able to get quite a bit of water, considering we have a humidity of around 40% here very often.
Peter, could you turn down your radio? I'm hearing a bit of an echo.
Yeah.
My radio's not on.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Maybe it's Bob.
Not quite sure what it was. Maybe it's Peter's.
Yeah.
Because it goes away.
Yeah, but so new solutions.
I have a question for you, Peter, which is I'm curious what you think are some of the most promising possibilities that we could discuss as a community and how to move forward.
Well, I'm kind of in a catch-22 in both my positions because, one, I'm on the Resource Conservation District, and one of our jobs is to maintain and actually rehabilitate the ecology within my district and watershed. And on the other hand, I'm on the Ag Water Advisory Committee, and we're always looking for ways to build up the resources, infrastructure, and storage, as you had said.
But yeah, catch it upstream during the floods, right?
Right, and there's the issue of dams and stuff. I really personally don't like putting dams on rivers and creeks where it inhibits the ecology and the riparian habitat of those, but there are.
I think that's enlightened. I think we have to start thinking like humans who affect the wildlife with everything we touch.
Well, here's the caveat to all that. Reservoirs are actually good things. Unfortunately, they tend to lose 15 and perhaps 20% of their water through evaporation.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Instead of going in the air. We should take it out of the air, then.
Well, we should take it out of the air, and we should figure out, of course, the district here restores groundwater is the best place to store your water because there's no evaporation.
Yeah.
It's held in place, and it stays clean.
Mm-hmm.
As far as reservoirs are concerned, I think that we could build some and transfer water to these reservoirs, but we have to pick areas and valleys and perhaps that are not sensitive to riparian habitat and fish.
Oh.
And San Luis Reservoir is a perfect example. It's built on pretty much a big arroyo that even in the wettest years ever would never fill that way. And most of the water that's in San Luis Reservoir near Los Banos is pumped in from the delta.
Hmm.
And that's the other problem. There's too much water being taken out of the delta, and that ecology has literally been destroyed.
Wow.
We got to figure it out somehow how we're going to be able to maintain water and maintain the ecology of all our
water. So what about something about better use of the water we have? Like, for instance, I have to say every time I flush a toilet, I'm considering whether or not we should be using water for that.
Well, if it's
and
mellow.
What, you know, 100 years ago, before they invented flush toilets, basically people were putting excrement in the soil, right? Directly, without that much water.
How about urinals in the home?
You know, there's composting toilets.
Yeah.
If you go to Arizona, like in the Valley of the Sun and the Phoenix area, there's purple pipe everywhere. So they're recycling tertiary treatment, and they're using that to fill their decorative ponds and their landscaping. And also, they've incentivized people to pull out their lawns and plant arid landscapes.
Mm-hmm. Does that help? I mean, is it possible to do something with your land that actually increases the amount of water that's coming in?
Well, reducing water. Cactus, not grass.
Well, yeah, not sucking it up, but I feel that...
But creating more water? Well,
when I was a kid, we used to talk about the rain cycle, and the plants are certainly part of an evaporation reclamation system.
Right. Well, if you look at Arizona, if there's a housing development goes in, first of all, they got to somehow procure the water for the development. And in that development, there has to be catch basins incorporated into the design plan of that development. And those catch basins do two things. They catch flood water during the monsoons and the heavy rainy seasons, and they percolate it into the local groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that, and that's kind of mandated by law there.
Mm-hmm. And of course, that's because that's a flash flood desert climate. And so it makes a lot of sense. And I think our climate maybe has some of those qualities. But listen, we have to go to a break. Can we just continue this in a couple minutes?
Sure.
Okay, great.
Great.
So we'll be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the show here. Now, one of the solutions I see with the water crisis are some new technologies like hydrophilic sponges, amazing things, and ways in which our cities can more effectively look at these new ideas and evaluate them quickly and implement them, which is the job of the government to do. Now, what's the infrastructure in which that can happen best?
Hmm.
And maybe perhaps being in the system, you would have more of a understanding of that.
Hitting it to you, Peter. What do you think about
you, Peter.
That?
Well, I think it's all-inclusive approach. And Mrs. Future was talking about the fact that we don't have flash floods around here, although during really wet years, we do get a lot of flooding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that these developers really need to be held to their feet to the fire regarding building cisterns and catch basins, which will definitely help the groundwater.
Yeah. Built into the house methods of capturing the water and utilizing it.
So really you're talking about zoning so that the groundwater replacement is part of the mandate.
Yeah, and I think that the Valley District does a good job of building perk ponds and stuff, but they're sort of restricted by, in somewhat by state law regarding doing work in stream beds. The funny thing about the district is they're also the ones that handle flood control, which is actually an oxymoron to percolation because you're running the water off too fast. So one plan that they have that makes a lot of sense is that they want to partner with farmers in the area so that they can fallow some land to use for percolation in the wet years.
Sure, and course, how about we call it a riparian zone and put some riparian life forms in there?
Well, cover cropping is another thing that is very important. These days with the chemical, I've been an organic farmer for the last 30 years plus. But I found with cover cropping, first of all, on your land when it's fallow, that not only the water that runs out of the county ditch when it is flooding is all muddy and turbid, by the time it leaves our property, it's fairly clean because it's been filtered through the grass. And also that grass holds back the water so that it does percolate. And then when that grass and cover crop dies off, the root system acts as a wick. And it wicks moisture up and down for the whatever crop you plant. I'd like to see more of that type of agriculture, although economically it's kind of tough because you got a cover crop. And most guys, you see the plastic mulch they put on the furrow beds. That's so they can plant immediately and they don't have that extra process of planting.
Yeah, the fallow year.
Yeah, they don't have that extra process, and that actually keeps weed backs. And plus, they tend to mechanically control weeds through chemicals, which all this stuff ends up in the creeks. And that's a big issue for me personally.
So I wonder if we couldn't take a bird's eye view of the problem and maybe get them some funding for that is otherwise necessary for water treatment that goes to creating weed filtering and fallow land.
You know, it's hard because the farmers need to make a living, especially in the California environment, which is it's probably at least twice as expensive to operate in California than it is anywhere else in the country, although we do have the greatest growing season and some of the greatest soil in the world. And that brings me to the other subject of burying soil in concrete asphalt homes. we've been, the Santa Clara Valley has buried some of the most prime agricultural land in the world. Underneath Google and Microsoft and all those other folks. And the problem with construction is that that acreage is no longer there for percolation into the groundwater, so the groundwater basins suffer. I mean, if you look back in the geologic history of this valley, it was a swamp.
So do you think the real problem is just that we have so many people that are coming from all over, they're unaccounted, maybe they're coming from the southern border, maybe they're people homeless from other places settling out here in California, but we just have too many people, and that causes us to make too many houses, and we don't have enough water or land to feed them. That sounds like China's problem.
We're not as bad as China, but what we have to realize is that you get 100 or so miles west of the Mississippi, and it's pretty much semi-arid to desert land all the way to the coast where you folks are. And almost half the population in the country lives in that area west of Mississippi. And most of this planting that was done for the West was done in perhaps a couple of the wettest recent centuries in the world, the 19th and the 20th century. There was a lot of water then. And nobody looked at the history because there was droughts that lasted literally decades and even a century in the West prior to the white man showing up. And even during when Anglo farmers and population ended up in the West, we still had drought incidences.
So maybe we need more advice from the Native Americans on how to live in balance on the land here.
Were they an agrarian culture? I don't think they had farms like we do.
It doesn't. It's the farmer and the cowman. And more, it's both.
Well, some of the cultures did have farms. And I literally, one of them, I think it was Anasazi's, disappeared the drought of 1275 to 1300.
The Anasazi?
They were farmers?
Yeah, weren't they the farmers in the Pueblos, Indians? Weren't they they were agricultural?
I'm familiar with their Pueblo. I don't know what their lifestyle was like.
Yeah, I think they were agricultural, and the drought destroyed them as it has many a civilization. That's what we got to look at the history of that, because civilizations have come and gone because of what I would quote climate change. Even prior to 414 Hemis, Dodge Hemis being around. And nobody's planned. It kind of irritates me that the state of California, I mean, that's the most serious issue facing the West is water. And nobody, it doesn't get talked about in the right places, like the legislature and the governor's office and even the federal government.
Well, I asked Google, And they say, of the Native Americans, the Sioux and the Cheyenne gave up agriculture to become nomadic. And others, in Iowa and Missouri particularly, continued to farm while also hunting buffalo.
It doesn't say anything about the Pueblo Indians, because I know that they had it.
Were the Pueblo.
They did have it.
Yeah, I'll ask that.
Well, again, we really have to come up with a way of talking to each other, human to human, without filtering the conversation through some PhD program where you have to know how carbon units are traded or something. There has to be a way of, if there's not enough water in your neighborhood for everyone to do what they need to do, then what can we do about it with common sense and pulling together and coming up with something smart? That's the kind of conversations we need to have.
Exactly. And there's a lot of people in this area, if you think about it, and Southern California. And somehow we have to educate the people to not leave their faucet running when they're washing dishes.
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Oh, I am so funny. People give me a hard time because I'm kind of a unconscious dishwasher Nazi. I don't mean to use Nazi, but I am very much always the way people listen to like a baby's cry. I'm that way with the water running when people are washing dishes. And I have a whole method for washing dishes where I don't run the water until things have soaked in a bowl and been sudsed with a sponge.
Okay, listen, I got one more Dr. Future story before the end
and
of the hour.
And then they get rinsed once with the water running. So I had to say that. Thanks for giving me the chance there, Peter.
And Peter, finally, it turns out you're right. Pueblo people were farmers. They mostly cultivated cotton and irrigated fields in river bottoms. So, yes, they were very aware of that. So
I'm open to us showcasing people who have positive suggestions for water in their home or in the neighborhood or even if they're aware of the water systems. So thanks for initiating that conversation, Peter. Appreciate it.
Great, Peter.
Yeah, appreciate your input.
It's so important. I really appreciate you guys letting me give my spiel on it all because I do have some experience in this.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And bring in new information anytime. Feel free to call. We're really interested in the topic.
Oh, definitely. I love your show. It's great.
Oh, cool. Thanks. Glad you're into it.
Thank you, folks.
Okay, more to come. Last minute of the first hour.
Okay, I just want to mention, you know how the Saudis have got this bad reputation because of their leader being a murderer? Anyway, he does other things, too. Yeah, we're being accused of. They have a plan for a 105-mile-long skyscraper in the Saudi desert.
Isn't that weird? They do so many amazing things. This architecture firm that they're doing, Danzine, is really famous for
105-mile-long skyscraper.
Out there designs.
They're going to put 9 million people in it.
Wow.
Size of New York City.
All right. Well, ponder that during the break. Here we go.
And it's part of a larger project called NEOM, which is a $500 billion ultra-high-tech future megacity in Saudi Arabia.
Wow.
$500 billion.
Would you like to live in a building that was 105 miles long? This is KSCO Santa Cruz.
And now, your host, Dr. Future.
Hey, folks. Welcome back to the show. Welcome back, Mrs. Future.
Thank you, honey.
And Bobby in San Francisco?
Yeah.
Good. Yeah, you will enjoy this very much, I think. Don Davis is our space artist guest coming up. He is known for his portrayals of space-related subjects. He is characterized by attention to detail and authentic portrayals based on what is known about the object he's painting. Welcome to the show, Don.
Hello there. It's great to be back on.
Yeah, good to have you.
It's been too long. It's so nice to get your perspective on reality.
Yeah, and you know, absolutely. You've been around for when the Hubble came out. You were a famous space scientist way back then even.
Space artist.
You're an amateur astronomer too, so you kind of skirt the line there between art and science. So back then, you were aware of the Hubble coming in. Now, does James Webb Telescope compare in impact to you compared to when you first experienced the Hubble?
I'd say very much so. Hubble was revelatory in its sheer resolution, the detail that it could pick up and can pick up that is largely denied Earth-based telescopes because of our atmosphere.
Yes.
And that same atmosphere also kind of restricts the wavelengths of light that reach the ground, including the infrared. And this is where the James Webb Space Telescope shines in wavelengths we can't see, and this lets us see deep into the infrared.
Now, for the uninitiated, could you go a little more detail about why that's important?
The wavelengths that we see, even if you take a photograph of a earthly subject and you look at the different wavelengths in that visible light picture, the red, green, and blue, if you look at those different grayscale image channels that make up the image will look quite different depending upon what you're seeing.
Yeah.
And that difference is extended enormously as you get into infrared, because we have a lot of subtle things in the universe that don't show up so well in visible light.
But they do in infrared. So infrared
But they do in infrared.
Uh-huh.
And that's partly like wisps of shreds of gas and dust that are throughout the galaxy. Earlier, lower resolution space telescopes have done sky surveys that show the whole sky basically is covered with this wisps of tufts and tendrils of nebula, basically gas and dust. We can call it smoke. And Webb has brought that to the level of detail, basically, of the Hubble telescope. And there is so much that can be seen of distant things. One of the very few images that have been released so far.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just beginning. I mean, it's going to be a treasure trove.
All kinds of things out there, yeah.
But there's a nebula that, basically, an outburst nebula. They call it a planetary nebula because through a telescope, they look almost like ghost planets, more or less spherical or oval. Puffs of eruptions from an aging star. And there's a lot of stuff beyond the visible light that was picked up beautifully by the Webb telescope. And there's another famous example is this group of galaxies called Stefan's Quintet.
Mm-hmm. Yes, those are one of the original pictures that they were showing us.
Yes, and in fact, those galaxies have been kind of burned into the public consciousness in a way by the beginning of It's a Wonderful Life, where different angelic entities are discussing things among each other, and members of that galaxy cluster are shown kind of glimmering as the words are spoken. So,
how cool.
So that's sort of been in the background. And of course, the later big telescopes on the ground took somewhat better pictures, and the Hubble, of course, did. But the Webb, when you look at the pictures, they're very different because we're seeing structures of dust that make up, for all intents and purposes, the skeleton of these galaxies. Sort of like X-rays reveal the underlying support structures and bones of our bodies.
Mm-hmm. And what are the bones of a galaxy made of?
Dust, gas and dust. There, if you look at other galaxies in visible light, you'll see them as dark areas, dark spiral, more or less, branching strands and globules and clouds of dark dust. They're dark, they're opaque. And
I'm just wondering a little bit, the dust, and what does it make? Is it making the planets?
It's the material from which stars are born. In fact,
stars, it's making stars out, then.
They're
it's
making dust. Stars.
And dust to stars.
If you look at the spiral arms are best traced by these dark clouds, and the stars tend to form on the outside of these clusters and tufts of regions of stars that make up the brighter, more visible spiral arms. Oh. But just when you look at it through infrared, we're seeing more of that dust at the expense of the stars, but that's what Hubble does. So the other thing that's great about Webb is it can peer through some of this dust and see what's on the other side. So they look more transparent. If you look at a nebula or something like that, you'll see stars all the way through it. Again, with the analogy of X-rays, so you can see light that passes.
So if we look into into the center of the Milky Way, we should be able to get clearer pictures of the galaxy.
That is the site I am waiting for at the edge of my seat because almost everything that we're seeing in the center of the galaxy is heavily obscured.
Yeah.
But through the radio wavelengths, we see these intriguing spiral structures of gas that are pouring themselves into the central black hole and may well be an intriguing bridges between these radio wavelength images and the infrared that will give us some insights, extra look in greater detail and help us to understand this intriguing part of our galaxy.
Yeah, I've heard that the center of our galaxy might have been a different galaxy at one point. We're the result of a collision of two galaxies in the past.
They do happen, and
the Milky Way. Hey, can you hold on for a few more minutes? We'd love to have you in the next segment.
Of course.
Okay, thank you. We're talking to Don Davis, space artist, about the new telescopic
images from the James Webb.
The James Webb and
telescope.
The things we can see and looking into our, the center of our own galaxy would be quite interesting, don't you think?
All right, be right back.
Okay, welcome back to the show. We're talking to Don Davis, space artist extraordinaire. Don, so the telescope would work quite well with our own galaxy then, but what about our solar system? Can it do close-up work like Saturn and Venus and give us new information?
Sure, it could do some, at least of the outer planets, but it's really not designed for solar system imaging as well as Hubble was. Mm. But there is, among the first batches of pictures, a nice infrared image of Jupiter showing basically the brighter areas of heat glowing from within, with the denser areas of cloud at the very top making things look darker. So it's a very different look, and it promises to be a valuable tool for helping to explore the outer solar system, which hopefully will get more spacecraft to one of these decades.
Yes, indeed. Though the infrared should reveal heat signatures, it seems to me, like we'd be able to see if some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn might be hot.
Yes, absolutely. Determining, like, you know, temperatures of things and who knows what else. You know, that may be things like rings around certain asteroids or...
Yes, or maybe asteroids that are hot.
Yes, for whatever reason. You know, the thing about Webb, which I'm so glad to see how resources get sometimes put into the right thing. I mean, the Webb telescope had a torturous gestation development period, and it ended up costing as much as an aircraft carrier.
$10 billion, frankly, I believe.
Yeah, but I'm glad. I would rather see that kind of money put into something that will expand our horizons and inspire people than just another aircraft carrier.
Yeah, hey, we just spent $60 billion on the Ukraine without hardly thinking about it.
You know, yes, so. It seems that there's a blank check if you're in the right department of the government.
Yeah.
Seems like it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As an artist, you must have seen thousands and thousands of views of the cosmos by this time. At this point in your life, what would you most like to paint?
Oh, gosh.
Anything in particular that you think the web might reveal that hasn't been available to you before?
Yes. Well, of course, there will be sources of inspiration and details of processes seen. Things like solar system formations with there'll be distinctive curdled spiral textures of gas circling young stars, and it'll be, in other words, clues of things that will give me insights as to things, wow, what would it be like to be up close to see something like this and talk to people who are experts in that particular object or what, and pick their brains a little to try to look a little further than what the image shows at face value. I've seen people talk in past years that space telescopes are making space art less relevant, but I see that as completely wrong because they open up new areas. Even a little corner of a Hubble or a Webb image can be a source of inspiration and something visually intriguing that we can expound upon. And, you know, the power of consciousness applied to our perception of the cosmos. And,
you can project a little bit. Yeah, you can sort of imagine what it might look like. I imagine, for example, you'd probably be pretty good at visualizing exoplanets.
Well, yes, it's a matter of their size, distance from the star.
The new information will be coming in from Webb on that too, right?
Yes. It's a wonderful book I've got in my library, Planets for Man by Stephen Dole and Isaac Asimov, where they try to work out the perimeters of size and various other physical things for habitability in worlds. And that kind work has been greatly expounded on in a decade since that was written. And we're going to get pictures of exoplanets, and we're going to get also spectrum of them and intriguing clues about what kind of gases are surrounding these worlds. And sooner or later, we're going to find some world that looks for all intents and purposes like Earth would from a similar perspective. And that will invite all kinds of pondering by people. It'll help catch the public imagination.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, how similar so far, Don, if we found an exoplanet that's similar to Earth?
I don't know that we have yet. We've gotten some that are close, right about the right size, and I think even some in the habitable zone, but nothing, to the best of my knowledge, like we've detected any oxygen or anything like that.
Nothing that's just right, just yet.
Or nothing that has taken the opportunity that their conditions offer to actually develop life. But we're so early in this search, and a negative result right now is meaningless. And as time passes, again, the web images are just going to be piling in. There's already a significant number beyond the ones that have been publicly released that are on a available to people on the web, on the other web. So it can be processed by, I haven't done this yet because I haven't figured out how to work with the arcane image formats of gigabyte size images that they master things in. But other people are putting stuff up on Twitter. Most of them are star fields or rather minimal like engineering test images. But again, in the months and years ahead, we're going to see not only the things that web can uniquely see, but we're also going to see their images combined with pre-existing Hubble images about the same level of detail, and that will enrich the knowledge that all those pictures that Hubble took in the past that web is going to be supplementing with its own. It'll just be a wonderful revelatory thing all over again.
Yeah, I can see that. Now, do you have a question coming in wondering, what about amateur astronomers? What role will they play in this future where the big telescopes...
Oh, a big role, because the technology has advanced to all potential users. There are people now with telescopes taking just incredible images, even some that approach Hubble's level of detail.
Really?
The Pic-du-Midi Observatory over in France, and they seem to be blessed by the gods of randomness with the clearest path of one of the clearest paths of air on the planet that makes for steady seeing. There's a few other places like that, including one in the U.S. So the thing is, they're not only in detail, but that's the few of the high-end guys, but there's thousands of people now doing such good amateur or astrophotography work. I thought of getting into that field, but there are so many people that are so good at it. I'd rather stick to my stylus and tablet and my airbrush and my paintbrushes.
Is there any chance that adaptive optics will make it into the amateur world?
I believe that's already the case. There's
really?
But I've only seen star field tests or of stars. But yes, they're very definitely...
Because adaptive optics would help cancel the atmosphere as part of the interference patterns of seeing.
That's correct.
The
some of the highest-end observatories on Earth are using that. And I've seen one picture. The potential of this is incredible, where we can see like a satellite of Jupiter, like Io, and you can see all the dark dots where the calderas are filled with dark lava and such. And so it's like a far encounter picture from Voyager or something. So they can get pictures that are like 10 times the resolution of Hubble using adaptive optics.
Amazing.
For some. But it's a hard, you know, it's scheduling telescope time for planets is usually a uphill struggle. But the amateurs are getting, I've seen some photos by the amateurs. In fact, many amateurs routinely take pictures of the planets, for instance, that are far superior to what even the 200-inch Hale telescope, the largest telescope in the world for many years.
Wow, really? So you can really do stuff then today. And how about collective projects? Are there any like citizen scientists, the networked projects, like they did with SETI for looking at stars?
There's a number of dedicated amateur astronomers out there, and I'm only aware of a fraction of them, but there's doing all kinds of things, not just taking pictures, but doing things like measuring the brightness of stars and as they dim due to like a planet moving in front of them, an exoplanet. There's amateurs are able to do very good work that supplements that of the larger observatories that can't always donate telescope time to this or that observation.
Mm. Wow. Very interesting. Another question coming in. Are planetariums updating their software to deal with all these new discoveries?
Oh, yeah, that's routinely done. The top people in that field, they have libraries of images that are...
Planetariums?
And of all sky surveys that have that can show you the whole sky and you know, any number of wavelengths that have been captured. There are some online resources also that allow that. So definitely the planetariums are the ones equipped with digital resources especially are definitely leaping into that new frontier as well as everybody else interested in astronomy.
As everybody else, right.
So I'm curious, Don, what is your particular passion right now with your creative process?
Yeah, what are we going to see next on Facebook, Don?
What are you paying attention to?
Well, living here in Joshua Tree, I pay attention to the sky a lot, the terrestrial sky and weather.
Oh, I've seen your beautiful pictures you've been posting. Yeah.
I love it here, and my only regret is that I didn't move to Joshua Tree earlier. The night skies here, I can go a little ways out of town, and we get skies that are just as dark as you could please. So a lot of my creative thing is just looking at that, capturing the sky in time-lapse sequences, especially with a fisheye lens, so I capture the entire hemispheric view, and those can be used in some future planetarium applications.
Awesome. Wow.
Yeah. And, of course, I'm keeping my painting going. I'm working on a little globe of Mars, actually, that I'm coloring to match the recent spacecraft photographs of the planet from the United Arab Emirates Hope mission, which have produced the best color photographs of Mars as a whole disc of all time so far.
Wow, fantastic. Well, listen, if people want to know more, how best to reach you? Do you have a website that you'd like to put out?
Yes, I have a website, donaldedavis.com. I'll caution you that it's antiquated and creaky, and I'm working on updating it, but at least there's contact info there.
Donald E. Davis, and good. And we can see some of your space art there.
All right, Don. Thanks so much. It's been so great having you.
Yeah.
And just talking
Thank
about
so
the sky with you.
On.
Yeah, I really appreciate
Thanks
your input
so much.
On this amazing
Bye-bye.
Future we're creating. Thank you. Okay, future's bright in the astronomical world, I would say, in the art space artist world.
It's
that's
golden.
Good.
Absolutely.
That's
golden.
Where we're going to see the bigger universe. All right. Be right back. Okay, welcome back to the show. That was Don Davis, our space artist friend down in the desert.
That's right. Yeah, he put some beautiful stuff up on his Facebook that I catch every now and then.
Yeah, can you imagine that? Imagine suddenly having all these new photographs to work in your field. You know, you're a specialist in shooting objects in the sky, and then, wham, suddenly you have a whole new vista.
A whole new vista. You have a whole new grain of sand that's full of dozens of new galaxies.
Well, every point in the sky, like a grain of sand, has a vista.
Yeah.
So it's an infinity, right? You know,
that's
it's kind
right.
of an infinity of possibilities.
That's
like, right.
Right
here, for
you
real.
You got to make your
that's
own significance
real.
Because if you compare yourself to all that is, we're very, very, very small.
Now, here's the other thing. Now we've always thought of ourselves as an innovative culture. Americans who created the internet, you know, created automobiles.
Yeah, we like stuff
electricity,
that's new.
At least most of that within the 19th century. But what have we done lately? Well, computers, you know, so big stuff, right?
Sure.
Well,
cell phones?
Yeah, this, the camera phone came from Santa Cruz.
Bitcoin.
Do you know that? Yeah, Bitcoin. Yeah, it's pretty good. Pretty good. But, okay, I just wanted to point out what other people are thinking and that we should actually be able to do better.
Oh, how about holograms? Holographic games like Pokemon?
I don't know. That's not my thing.
Well,
maybe yours.
No. It's not my thing. I just remember thinking how innovative it was that you could have a hold up your phone and see a virtual object that you couldn't see without your phone. That's what I'm talking about.
Virtual reality? Augmented reality.
AR.
Yeah. Augmented reality. Yes, yes. Yeah. That's next. That's right. That's huge, too.
Yeah. Anyway,
and maybe these are
things.
All tools for this. In Saudi Arabia, authorities there have revealed plans for, I started to mention this just before our guest came on, of an architectural project so ambitious that it's almost unbelievable. And that's that 105-mile-long skyscraper.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about stories. I'm talking miles.
They're calling
105
it
miles.
The line.
the line, right? It's more like a skyscraper on the side, if you ask me,
right?
From what I can see.
But it's also tall. I mean, it's up there with the tallest skyscraper buildings.
Tall and long.
Yes. Let's see, what's the height? 1,640 feet tall.
Yeah. It's like a giant phallus.
Right.
Now, the king is young there, I understand.
No, you could call this the Great Wall of Saudi Arabia.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could, because it takes up so much space.
They call it.
Right.
And it's part of their mega city project where they're
putting
on.
But you could have a bullet train that got you from anywhere to anywhere across the top of it, right?
Now, they're living in the desert. You could. Yeah, you could do a lot of things. Your transportation, I'm sure, is one of the things you're thinking of right there. Mm-hmm. But the idea, though, is that they're looking at building internal spaces because it's so hot there. This is kind of like Mars in the opposite. Mars is cold. This is hot. The building would be completely self-contained in terms of its air and water and infrastructure and transportation.
Sort of like hotels in Las Vegas. They air conditioned.
You can walk from one to the...
The whole environment is inside. It's like a spaceship. I felt like I was in a spaceship when we were walking through the hallways under the streets.
The spaceship concept is starting to manifest on the ground here.
That's
as
right.
Well.
We're starting to turn Earth into a spaceship.
Yeah.
It already was, but we're starting to treat it like one that we could take to space.
But the difference here is that they're thinking really big. They're thinking that this one building would accommodate 9 million residents.
Mm-hmm.
And be in
who would want to live in one building that way?
Up 13 square miles. Well, a lot of people would, as opposed to living in...
It's sort of like living in a shopping mall, though.
A squalor somewhere.
Well, sure, yeah. If the other options aren't available.
Well, people will make it habitable wherever, as long as you have the basics.
The thing
it's to be able to design it architecturally well is the challenge, to make it really interesting, not just a sterile.
I think that's the thing, is that when something is this minimalist, it's not natural. I don't think that I would really thrive there. It would be like living in a box.
I can see that. We can make it better.
It's very pretty. It's an art project. It's cool.
Layering,
it's got these giant mirror windows, the whole stretch of the 105-mile length.
Well, layering city functions vertically while giving people the ability of moving seamlessly in three dimensions is pretty cool.
Sure.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of, you remember the Christo art?
Yeah, it is. It's very Christo.
I mean, art project?
Yeah.
Like wrapping
art
an
project.
Island in a up as a package.
Yeah.
Well, do you remember there was the curtain in Sonoma that went all the way to the ocean? And it just kind of reminded me of that curtain.
Sure. Yeah, it's definitely
in the 60s,
along those lines.
It's just conceptually
huge
large art project.
Landscape
like that.
Art piece.
Yeah, I can see that. Though this takes it to the land of functionality by creating it an actual habitable zone.
I do believe you could 3D print it.
Print this long line and say, 9 million, you go here.
In 22 hours,
Let's do it on Mars, too, while we're at it.
Building.
Let's have a Mars line. You know, you stop thinking about it. It's very close to being a spaceship because they're controlling the air involved. How much more complicated is it to create it so that it's a completely self-contained environment? You know, it's almost there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's going to be a challenge to see how to make it both self-contained and ecological and sustainable. It has to nurture the life within. Otherwise, nobody's
Well, that's a good question for the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman.
I mean, this would be a horrible prison.
Yes.
Right? It would
be
a horrible place to be stuck where there's no doors to the outside world.
Yeah, but basically, it's amazing what they're thinking of. Mm-hmm. All right? Now, we can do better, of course. I mean, I think the Apple circular design is better. Myself.
Yeah, I like things that are flower-shaped.
I think sticking a giant phallus is, only goes so far. I mean, it does go 105 miles. That's pretty far.
Yeah.
But
I'm
but
sure
circular
train lovers would love this concept.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's amazing what people over there are thinking.
Yeah.
And we should think about stuff like that, too.
Sure.
And we're the innovative country.
Innovation.
For sure.
If we had the money.
Well, we do. We have more money than they do.
Well,
you don't think so? They think of more disposable income there. They're spending less on infrastructure than we are.
I wish we would stop talking about money as the limiting factor. Imagination is the limiting factor. Will is the limiting factor. Mm-hmm. Human alignment, people putting their energy into it with purpose. Those are the limiting factors.
Mm.
And money is a stand-in for all those things. You know, money follows human intention goes.
They're talking about $500 billion to build a whole city.
Hey, it sounds cheap.
So we have a caller, Mrs. Future?
We do. We've got Nick in Royal Oaks to say.
Oh, Nick.
Nick, what you got for us today?
Well, hey, you know, a building that long, have they got plans about driving around it for deliveries?
Oh, yeah, they're thinking it through.
Well, the thing is, it's in the middle of the desert. I don't think there is anything around it. Yeah. So I think that this 105 miles is probably just connecting the water to the train tracks in the middle of the desert.
You don't want to leave the line. You want to stay in the line unless you really are a desert rat.
Yeah.
I'm looking at two pictures, and they're both of stars. One says color composite mosaic, and the other one says color composite image. Can you explain those terms?
No, I can't.
Color composite image, and what was the other one?
Are you looking at our article?
Mosaic.
Mosaic. No, an old guy in Telescope magazine.
Oh. Well, you know, a composite would be, like Don Davis was talking about, the fact that you've got different lenses that are looking at different frequencies of color light. And when they put, say, a red, green, blue, just for example, I don't know if that's accurate, but when you have one lens that only sees red light and one light that only sees green light and one light that only sees blue light, and you put all three of them together, you get a different picture than any one of them.
The composite.
That's the composite.
Yeah, the layering. That's what it's all about.
Oh, okay. Another frightening thing about water I've heard is we can wreck our ground basin, that it can go so dry that they can't recharge it.
Well, let's hope not. Let's treat Mother Nature like she's still alive, and we can help because we're smart enough and we want to.
We're smart enough, we're good enough, and gosh darn it, we care.
Yeah. I'm no yawning about our lawn.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks, Nick. We're going to keep going, okay?
Yeah. All right.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yes, thanks for calling, man.
Colonel Terry. Hi.
Colonel Terry.
Hi, everybody.
Hey.
Hi.
Very well, and you haven't exposed yourself COVID by going to a Trump rally?
No, just to KSCO.
It's not our speed. I'm still pretty non-political in my soul. I want everybody to win.
You don't want Trump to win, my dear.
That's the Bill Maher disaster, right?
You're too smart for that.
Yeah.
I'm calling regarding shapes and buildings and design. The Saudi Arabian building or structure you made reference to.
Yes.
Was miles long?
105 miles long. Think of a skyscraper on its side.
Okay, and how wide?
Imagine they wanted to serve as a home to 9 million people. So I don't know.
Probably going to be at least a mile wide.
All right, 105 miles. In a straight line?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, the desert is... They've got a lot of room in the desert there. It's like a giant sandbox.
All right, then how do you get down to visit Aunt Helen?
You took an elevator.
If you design the entire environment, you can have lots of forms of transportation built into the system.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm sure they're thinking it through. Elevators that go sideways, they had that in Star Trek, right?
Even that, I don't know if you've had the experience of being in Pentagon Building in Washington, D.C., but the circumstances were. It's 1939.
Yeah.
George Marshall and others forecast, we're going to be in the European war, and we might also be engaged in a war with Japan.
Oh, exciting, yes. Yeah,
We've got to coordinate the industrial activity and the recruiting people and all of those things.
Oh, boy.
In the war.
Right.
And we can't do it if we're spread out in seven different buildings. And, of course, the War Department had its own building and the Navy its and so forth.
Yeah.
How about if we start designing buildings that don't facilitate war?
But thin. The communications was thinner then.
Facilitate victory and then maintain the peace, which it did.
Yeah.
Now, point is, so how do you, again, this is before electronic delivery, even.
We're going to a break, Colonel Terry, just so you know. Keep it short.
All right. The efficiency of the building is, and it's wonderful to work in, because you can walk from the two furthest points of either side in less than 5 or 7 minutes. But you walk to the center.
Nice, nice.
That's a good design.
It makes more sense than a straight line. Welcome back to the show. We were just talking about building designs, especially city designs that resemble buildings. And Colonel Terry was talking about the efficiency of the Pentagon in Washington and how easy it is to reach the various
branches anywhere.
Yeah, pretty cool. Now, it could be...
And on the five levels, you've got 25,000 people or more working there. You've got restaurants convened in the center. And it's easy to to go visit your buddy at the furthest other part of the building.
You gotcha, like the hub design.
It is pretty efficient. Did it have any areas of entertainment as well there? Was it all business?
Oh, yeah. Theaters, chapels, a couple of extra, several restaurant locations, and, of course, assembly rooms. And yes, I've even gone to concerts there.
Oh, okay. Wow. So as a city building design, as a mega city, it might be an interesting concept to think about.
Yes, well, I'm surprised the Saudis didn't do that.
Well, conceivably inside the line, I mean, the line is a big box. I imagine they could have a lot of mini landscape experimental designs architected within it.
Yeah, and with the Space Force now, you'd need six. So you'd be a hexagon.
Well, not quite.
Six.
So it's kind of like climate control. Remember they used to design cities, imaginary cities under domes? This is like a city in a box.
Correct. And those are also in an oval, madam.
Right. Yeah, circles. Spheres are more efficient. You know, circles is the easiest way to get from edge to edge.
What is it Dr. Future wanted to say to me, please?
Well, I just wanted to know what you saw the future design of cities might be, and the Pentagon seems like a good idea. Do you have any other ideas along those lines?
Well, clearly we need to integrate gardens and parks the way they do in Singapore. You're familiar with that?
Nature.
Yeah, we
need more nature. All right. Thanks, Carl Tur. I'm going to keep going because we've got people
waiting.
Yeah,
more nature. Well, it's at the center of the Pentagon for that.
Appreciate it.
Thank you,
Kerry. You too.
All right.
Bye. And next, we have Billy Sunshine.
Billy.
Hey.
How you doing?
Hello, son. Hello, Bobby. Hello, Al.
Hello, everybody? Billy.
Good? Billy.
We're good, yes.
Love you guys. I can't wait to meet Bobby again.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Come over later tonight.
Yeah. Today's the day, Billy. Stop on by.
Yeah, okay. I'd love to.
Okay.
Today?
Yeah.
I'm going over there tonight.
It might be a little late.
A few hours he's notice, on his way.
But you know, he's got a longer drive than you do.
Yeah. We'll stay in touch.
Two hours.
So in the 90s, I lived in Hong Kong.
In Hong Kong, that's pretty dense.
Humid city.
Yeah.
So you could go from like Pacific Place, where Intel had its offices, to all the way to the Star Ferry, never having to go out in that horrible heat and humidity.
Oh, so it was already internal environment.
Yeah.
You're
either underground or you're in the bottom of buildings, but you never have to go outside.
Yeah, like Las Vegas. It's like that. Montreal is like that, too.
Houston's like that.
Yeah, wherever it's inhospitable outside, it seems to be that's where we go.
Well, we did evolve from animals that tunneled.
In the summertime, I refer to Vegas as hell with slot machines.
And air conditioning.
Have you ever been in the Apple Circle or building?
No, but I am familiar with it, and it is amazing design. I think it's something that could be the future. I like it better than a giant 100-mile-long phallus, but
The donut.
The donut seems to be a little more efficient, and I don't mind going in circles sometimes to get places. And Colonel Terry was in the Pentagon, you know, so it's kind of related.
Yeah. Radial cities.
I think circles are the way to go.
Yeah, circles, yeah.
It occurs so naturally in nature that they're sending us a message.
Yes, yeah. Circular cities.
Circles are speaking to you.
We certainly got a lot of land out there with nothing there because it's uninhabitable. And if we get the water from the air, that will solve that problem.
Yeah.
And then it's a question of dealing with the sanitation and waste.
Well, this is the age of Aquarius, so we're going to have to take better care of our water because it looks like it's going to be less abundant than it was in the past.
Yeah, and NASA's thought a lot about that, having to run the space station for all these years.
Yeah. Right.
You got to watch.
Yeah, water has got to be our theme for almost parts of everything we do and think from now on.
Yeah.
Well, apparently the water holes were the original churches in the ancient world.
Yeah, here we come.
Humans go back to water. It is sacred.
Animals, humans, we all require it.
Well, we're 80% water ourselves, right?
All right. Thanks, Bill. Yeah. Good to talk to you. Bye. Right. See you later.
Till later.
We now have Johnny Sims in Salinas.
Johnny, welcome to the show.
Yes, Johnny.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
We're good. Yourself?
Pretty good. I just want to state a few facts.
Mm-hmm.
I think your guys' show is terrific, for one.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Hit the button on your desk.
The right button.
Oh, man. Just as you get
you
your thoughts together.
You are not allowed to say that on our show or on radio, know. Johnny. You got to watch what comes out your mouth.
Did you remember what you said?
I had to dump that. I hope I caught it.
Yeah, good. You caught it, Mrs. Future. That was good.
I hit all the buttons I could.
Put it back in for the podcast, though.
Okay, so... he's gone. All right.
Oh, really?
On that note.
Well, call back. Call back.
Johnny, we did want to know what you had to say. Sorry about that. But, yeah, you know,
nature of AM and FM.
We're just not allowed to say those words. You can spell it, but you can't say it.
Okay. Well, we have a few minutes left. I want to point this out. This is in Bobby's line, too. There was a very interesting piece in Neuroscience News about how Alzheimer's can be detected in blood 17 years before symptoms.
Uh-oh.
17 years before symptoms.
And
all right,
so
and then you can do preventative measures to make sure you...
Yeah, that's what I was hoping.
Don't do it.
You know?
Don't have to do it. But
don't want it to be a death
sentence. There's a very interesting article that I have in our links page about that and how is that possible. You know, what is it in the blood that reveals that you might... Well, you.
And they just discovered it, right? I mean, basically, they developed this new test and they looked at some old frozen blood.
Well, using immuno-infrared sensors, they're able to identify signs of the disease early. It's a certain folding of proteins that you're looking for.
The amyloid. Right.
So is it the tau-181 biomarker? Is that I'm reading that right now. So instead of looking for the beta amyloids or the amyloid betas that were shown to be falsely...
The p-tau-181 is actually the other marker that indicates Alzheimer's, but it doesn't give you that 17-year warning. This is another phenomenon. Yeah.
All right.
Anyway, we'll get back to that.
drfutureshow.com, and you can read those articles for yourself. And here we have Johnny calling back. Did you wash out your mouth with soap, Johnny?
Yes, ma'am. I apologize for that. I just wanted to ask your inquiry about two questions. How do you feel about stem cell research?
Oh, I think it's good for us. I mean, we are born with cells that have a perfect map of everything necessary to build the body that we live in. And the understanding of stem cells is understanding the process of how to use that original information to repair things that are wrong. So
yeah.
I'm very much in favor of... understanding it.
Yes,
and
I'd say this.
You got to cultivate your own stem cells.
Build body better. Build body better.
Let me ask the next question.
Yes.
Before I ask the third question, where do you get stem cells to use for
skin? You get them from
grow
skin
your
now.
Own, baby.
You do not get them from fetuses anymore. You
article
get them from skin.
In this Slate
skin.
About the Japanese doctors who succeeded in growing new mice from the skin of
skin
frozen. Non-living mice. They created it from stem cells.
Can you explain that again? Because there was too many people talking at the same time. I didn't understand it.
Stem cells can come from skin. Cultivate your own.
Yeah. No fetuses required.
It doesn't matter.
No.
It doesn't matter where it comes from. Those can come from any living being.
Any living tissue.
Well, if you grow your own from your own tissues, then
it's
yours. No harm, no foul.
It's got your code on it, man. Build body better.
Okay. That's really cool. I did not know that. That's really cool, actually.
Yeah, it is. It frees us up, doesn't it? You know, it gets us to the next level where we can all get on the same page and do something cool with it.
No, I did not know that, and that's super good information to know.
Yeah.
That's really cool.
What makes them stem cells is the fact that they're undifferentiated into specialized tissues, but that's just a stage of development that cells go through.
So for undifferential tissues, does it have to be human tissues or can it be any type of tissues?
Well, I'm not really a doctor, but I think it has to be the kind that created the body that you want to recreate.
Yeah, you won't have rejection problems that way. If you use your own cells, you won't have a rejection problem. Use your code, man. That's what it's there for.
That's right.
Yeah, use your own code.
Learn your code and use it wisely.
Your ultimate ID is your code, DNA code.
Well, that's cool. That's cool. That's really cool to know. My second question, second question.
Well, we're almost over the hour. We're at the very end of the show. And right. you have
Total
our attention
for question and answer. So go.
We might.
You guys interrupted me to give me a second question. Here's my second question. The only second question I have is, what do you guys think about marijuana?
What do I think about it?
Yeah.
I can't smoke it anymore.
I'm doing a major article, not just on marijuana, but on DMT, LSD, MDMA, and its interaction with brain control
interface. It's a plant ally. I'd say it's a plant ally.
Yeah, so if you ask me about marijuana, you're going to, you know, it's a big topic.
It is. Marijuana is way different from DMT and LSD.
Oh, like yeah. Oh, yeah, I would agree with you on that.
Those are way different from marijuana. It has nothing to do with DMT and LSD.
Oh, it has a lot to do in terms of therapy. But anyway, we've got to go.
This is the last 30 seconds of
the next show, and you
Thanks
can continue that
calling.
With
Thank you.
Our next host on KSCO. Ask him about marijuana and DMT. We'll be happy
anyway,
to answer that.
If you've listened to the show, you know we basically like it, advocate, people take
That's true.
Keep it real. Right. This is KSCO Santa Cruz. Bye-bye.